First case for argument is Greenberger against Geico Insurance. Mr. Hilecki.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. The core purpose of insurance is to make an insured whole when he or she suffers a loss, and Geico admitted in its summary judgment papers that its obligation was to pay for all repairs needed to restore Mr. Greenberger's car to its pre-loss condition. However, Brett Vance, who is the owner of a repair shop that was part of Geico's Select Repair Shop program during the events in question, testified, quote, "Geico refuses to pay for processes necessary to bring the cars back to pre-accident condition." And he also testified, quote, "It is our experience that Geico writes a low-ball sheet or an estimate just on the chance that the plaintiff will cash out as your customer did, meaning take the money, not get the car repaired, and maybe never find out that they've been shortchanged." Now, the district court believed, as to Mr. Greenberger's individual claim, that he failed to present any evidence sufficient to defeat Geico's summary judgment motion as to whether or not there was a breach of its...
What happened, counsel, to the class allegation in this complaint that led to its being in federal court?
The class allegations, they're still part of the complaint. We were in the process of getting ready to move for class certification at the time the summary judgment decision was handed down, Your Honor.
I don't know. What does it mean, getting in the process of getting ready to move? Rule 23C1 says that ruling on class certification is the first step in any case, not something that waits until the merits are decided or ready to be decided.
I understand, Your Honor.
So you mean to say the district judge just ignored, you didn't follow Rule 23C1, and the district judge just ignored it, is what you're saying?
I wouldn't know that we didn't follow it. I mean, I realize we had not moved for class or hadn't moved for class certification at the point.
Moving for class certification isn't what Rule 23C1 requires. It's addressed to the district judge. District judge's obligation depends on an allegation in a complaint, not on some motion. Class certification is not an option at the plaintiff's behest.
I understand, Your Honor. And I agree that the district court did not raise it sua sponte either.
We have well-shared responsibility. Nobody draws it to the district court's attention, and the district court ignores the allegation.
I understand Your Honor's point. With regard to the district court's decision that Mr. Greenberger failed to present evidence of a breach, we respectfully submit that that was error because Mr. Greenberger presented the evidence in at least two ways. First of all, he presented the unrebutted declaration of his auto repair expert, Ken Klein, an individual with more than 35 years of auto repair experience. He's taught auto repair, run his own repair shop for 20 years. He examined the Geico damage estimate on which the payment to Mr. Greenberger was based and explains in detail how the estimate resulted.
The next question is, since there is no certification in this case, isn't a remand to state court required? The conditions of its being in federal court don't seem to have been realized.
That's an interesting question, Judge. I don't believe so because I believe under CAFA, the jurisdictional requirements are determined based on the allegations in the complaint, not based on what actually transpires in the district court later on.
Well, it may or may not be so. There's a conflict among the district judges of the Northern District of Illinois that question. Have you done any research on this?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
But this is a question of federal subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
The number one issue in every case.
I understand.
One needs to research it, not just assume it.
My understanding at the time that the case was removed was that it was based on the allegations of the complaint. We didn't see a defect in the petition for removal. Obviously, if this court thought that subject matter jurisdiction was lacking, we agree that it would have to go back to state court. But turning back to Mr. Klein's declaration, he explains in detail how Geico failed to pay for all repairs needed to restore Mr. Greenberger's car to its pre-loss condition. He explains his conclusions in detail, and he expressly concluded in paragraph 10 that Geico, quote, did not pay him an amount sufficient to restore his car to its pre-loss condition. So that's certainly evidence of a breach of Geico's admitted obligation. Second, Mr. Greenberger presented the Lakeside estimate, which was obtained independently by a third party who was making an offer to buy Mr. Greenberger's damaged car. Was prepared by an auto repair professional, Sarkis Tokat, an independent body shop. And the Lakeside estimate states that the actual cost of repairing Mr. Greenberger's car was approximately $1,200 or 33% more than what Geico wrote in its estimate.
How do we test that? How do you test? How does your opponent test that? You don't have a car.
Your Honor, Geico got to inspect the car. That's how it wrote its estimate.
Well, yeah, but how do we check whether your experts are have a valid estimate?
Well, it's up to the fact finder to determine whether their explanation.
That may well be, but.
Yeah, well, that our position is it's up to the fact finder to determine whether or not the experts can satisfy their opinions.
The Illinois Supreme Court held in the Avery case that an examination of the car is required for that proof. And if the car is no longer available because your client gave it away, then there's a failure of proof necessarily under the Avery case, both on the contract claim and the fraud claim.
Your Honor, actually, Avery did not hold that as a matter of law. What happened in Avery...
Oh, sure it did. There was a lengthy, lengthy discussion of the multiple infirmities in the contract claim in that case, which is reasonably similar to the contract claim that you're bringing in this case.
Your Honor, what I'm talking about is that Avery did not hold that as a matter of law you need to inspect the car. Instead, what went on in that case...
Yes, it did.
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that that was a fact conclusion drawn from the fact that the plaintiff's experts in that case had conceded at trial that they would need to inspect the car. And what the court was talking about there was a specific insurance policy, because there's multiple insurance policies. One of them was the you agree policy. In addition to making that observation, the plaintiff's experts in that case had conceded as a matter of fact that an inspection of the car would be necessary. The court also noted that the insurance policies that it was talking about expressly provided that they could, that the insurance company could use non-OEM parts. My point with that is that it wasn't even necessary for the court to discuss what kind of evidence would be needed, because the court had already concluded at that point that
there
the policy...
There was a long discussion in the Avery case of the provision in the insurance policy and the theory of that of the case that pertained to the same theory that you're asserting here, that the policy provides that the car will be restored to its pre-loss condition. And the Avery court said that that required the examination of the vehicle to determine what its pre-loss condition was and whether the payment was adequate to achieve that restoration.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. The statement the court made in that case was about a fact concession made by the experts. It wasn't a conclusion of law. Furthermore, I would note that the facts of that case are also distinguishable, because what they were talking about there was whether the particular repair part that was being offered in the estimate to repair the car was as good as the repair part that the plaintiffs were claiming they were entitled to. You know, was an OEM part or a non-OEM part as good as an OEM part? And whereas here we're not complaining about the quality of the parts and whether the part when you put it on the car is that as good as it would be as if you had an OEM part. Instead, we're claiming that they're not paying for certain repairs that are needed to restore the car to its pre-loss condition. So, for example, by analogy, in Avery, you're looking at they use fender B, but we think they should use fender A. In our case, you're not getting a fender at all. So that also distinguishes Avery from our case, at least in terms of the facts. But turning back to the Lakeside estimate, I thought it was important to point out that the Lakeside estimate included many of the same repair procedures that Mr. Klein, our expert, concluded were missing from the Geico repair estimate. So in both of those ways, Mr. Greenberger presented sufficient evidence to show that Geico failed to fulfill its obligation of restoring his car to its pre-loss condition.
I still don't understand how you're going to prove that even to a fact finder if you don't have the car.
Well, Your Honor, the issue is not so much about the car as it is about the estimate that was written based on after an inspection of the car.
I understand that, but...
Your client didn't bargain for an estimate. Your client bargained for insurance coverage to restore his car to its pre-loss condition in the event of a collision.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The car is a necessary component of the proof in order to examine what it's going to take, how much money it's going to take to restore it to its pre-loss condition.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, there is absolutely no evidence in the record that that is the case. And to the contrary, there's three auto repair professionals that have testified in this case that they can determine from looking at an estimate whether it's missing certain repair procedures needed to restore a car.
The district court rejected that.
The district court didn't opine on whether or not Mr. Klein or Mr. Tokatz was able to render a valid opinion on whether the estimate was sufficient or not. Instead, she rejected Mr. Clump. Well, she disregarded the Lakeside estimate. The district court disregarded the Lakeside estimate altogether in summary judgment opinion, except to make a passing reference to it in the facts section. And as to Mr. Klein's declaration, the district court construed it to say something it simply does not say. The district court concluded that what Mr. Klein was actually talking about was what kind of repairs are needed in according to ASE or ICAR industry repair standards, instead of what repairs were actually needed to restore the car to its pre-loss condition. And in point of fact, Mr. Klein never said that in his declaration, and he doesn't even mention ASE standards or ICAR standards in his declaration. So the only way the district court could draw that conclusion is to be drawing an inference against Mr. Greenberger on that point, which the district court was not permitted to do at the summary judgment stage. Instead, the district court was obligated to draw all reasonable inferences in Mr. Greenberger's favor.
Well, what was his opinion based on, if not those industry standards?
Well, it's based on a variety of things. It's based on his experience in the auto in auto repair.
He's unrelated to industry standards.
It may or may not be related to industry standards, but he has he's been working in the auto repair industry for more than 35 years. He has hands-on experience from fixing cars. He's been running a repair shop for more than 20 years. He doesn't necessarily need to conclude that the repairs that were needed were required by industry standards. But as another point, the district court's inference that he was relying on industry standards instead of what it actually takes to repair a car, assume that inference is based on a number of assumptions for which there's no evidence. The district court was simply assuming, for example, that what industry standards require is somehow different than what is actually needed to repair a car or restore a car to its pre-loss condition. The district court was assuming that Mr. Klein was relying on those standards to the exclusion of all of his other experience. The district court was also assuming that there actually are industry repair standards for each of the particular repair procedures that Mr. Klein identified in his declaration as being improperly omitted from.
Well, isn't it possible that some of the repair procedures could be attributed to prior damage to the vehicle and not that particular accident?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I suppose it's possible, but that...
And how would you show that?
Well...
Or not show?
When an insurance company writes an auto repair estimate, what it does is it identifies what damage is pre-existing damage based on an inspection of the vehicle. So the estimate itself should tell you what was pre-existing damage. And in fact, on the GEICO estimate here, there's a notes section at the end that notes that there are, for example, there's door scuffs and right quarter scuff. There's no evidence in the record to say, I guess, that's actually pre-existing damage. But the point is that that's a standard industry procedure, and every insurance company I've ever dealt with has a procedure for identifying pre-existing damage because they don't want to pay to repair pre-existing damage.
In the absence of a vehicle?
Well, at all, ever.
Well, but do you usually have it in the absence of a vehicle?
I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's point, but I can't tell you that...
Well, if you don't have the car, you can't compare it to anything. You can't have an additional expert look at it to verify or to challenge anything, can you?
Well, obviously without the car, you can't inspect the car. That's true. However, our theory of the case is that we can determine based on the estimate it wrote, what the estimate that GEICO wrote, what was damaged, and based on the damage that GEICO itself has identified, an expert can tell you whether or not all the repair procedures listed to fix that damage are there or not. There might have been other damage on the car that we can't see, but we're not complaining about that. We're simply asking for a relief based on what was written in the estimate. And our experts can tell you, based on what was written in the estimate, whether all the repair procedures listed after that are actually complete or not.
Did your client submit to the appraisal process that the insurance policy requires?
Well, the insurance policy does not require an appraisal. It provides that option.
If there's a disagreement between the insured and the insurer about the amount of the loss, then the appraisal process kicks in, right?
If there's a disagreement, well, there's a time limit on it. You can only take advantage of that process if you do so within 60 days after the proof of loss is filed under the terms of the contract. Mr. Greenberger, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that he had any idea that his claim had been underpaid until long after that time period had expired. So, he did not avail himself of the appraisal process. If I may, I'd like to turn to the consumer fraud claim. The district court seemed to believe that you can't have a consumer fraud claim unless, or you can't have a consumer fraud claim based on allegations that also give rise to a breach of contract. And the basis for the district court's conclusion in that regard was Avery versus State Farm. However, Avery does not go that far. It doesn't categorically bar you from bringing a consumer fraud claim based on allegations that also give rise to a breach of contract. It simply says that a deceptive act or practice involves more than the mere fact that the defendant promised to do something and failed to do it, and that a breach of contractual promise without more is not actionable. But it did not say that every time you have a breach of contract claim, you cannot have a consumer fraud claim. Mr. Greenberger alleges more than a breach of contract in a variety of different ways. First of all, he alleges that GEICO's promise to pay his loss is false. False promise is expressly prohibited by the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. He also alleges that they failed to disclose that they have...
What's the concrete false statement?
The false promise to pay his loss. They shortchanged him, so they did not pay his loss. And they knew going in...
That just re-describes a claim of breach of contract. Is there any concrete false statement that's made? That is, do they advertise, we pay top dollar to get best repairs, or do they advertise, we follow the industry standards, anything like that?
There's no evidence in the record to that extent, Your Honor, other than, but the false promise to pay the loss is actionable under this court's decision in United States X Rel Maine versus Oakland City University, where the court distinguished a false promise from a mere breach of contract, stating that the mere failure to honor a promise is a breach of contract, but when you make a promise without having no intent of ever keeping it in the first place...
That's what the lower court found in Avery and what the Supreme Court of Illinois expressly rejected.
Your Honor...
If it had come out the other way, you'd have a much stronger claim.
Your Honor, I don't believe Avery addressed the false promise provisions of the Consumer Fraud Act. It did not say we reject the idea that you can have a false promise claim based on a breach of contract. If it pleases the Court, if there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Mr. Jacobs.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We are here in this matter where Mr. Greenberger, the appellant, has put forward in the lower court literally no evidence of breach of contract.
No, we don't need to start with the merits. We need to start with subject matter jurisdiction. The provision under which this case was removed to federal court deals with class actions that involve more than 100 people and more than $5 million. This case appears to involve one person, and for all I can tell, $4.95. Hey, why is this here?
Well, Your Honor, it's here because in the lower court, though GEICO was trying to push the case forward and continually tried to get discovery closed and to bring the case to the very decision point Your Honor is pointing out had not been reached, the case nonetheless reached summary judgment while the claim was still an individual claim. To speak to the questions, Your Honor, was...
Remind the district court of the need to certify a class before deciding the merits? Rule 23 could hardly be clearer. And, of course, the provision under which this case was removed is one for class actions.
Totally appreciate that, Your Honor. Totally appreciate the question. At the same time, we as the defendant are not the movement for class certification. We tried to move the case very aggressively.
Read Rule 23. There's nothing in Rule 23, despite what Mr. Hiller said, and despite that there's nothing in Rule 23 about a need to move for class certification. The onus is on the judge. If the complaint contains a class allegation, the judge must rule at the earliest practical opportunity. That's what the rule says. It doesn't say wait for some lawyer to file a motion. Now, when the judge doesn't carry out that duty, you would expect the lawyers to say, excuse me, stop, judge, we're not moving toward the merits. Your first duty is to rule on class certification, because if you don't, this case probably doesn't belong here at all.
Absolutely so, Your Honor.
Either side, remind the district judge of the need to certify this as a class or send it back to state court because it's not a class?
Not expressly, and the way we worked back to try to do exactly what Your Honor just said is you referenced the language at the earliest practicable time. And in the district courts, as a practical matter, when defending class actions, that means when some class discovery has been taken. And we fought like crazy to get the class discovery done as early and as soon as possible, which is the defendant is the most in what we could typically do to try to advance that process. We agree that it should have been sooner. We agree that class discovery, that typically the determination under Rule 23C1 is based upon, should have been done much sooner. But since we are the defendant, we are a little bit impaired compared to the other litigant at causing that process to culminate, but we agree that it was not as soon as it should have been, Your Honor, and it typically happens within the sound discretion of the district court's license to manage discovery, which is why when it goes slow in the district courts, Your Honor.
What inhibited that process?
The discovery process, Your Honor?
Right.
That's
what you're saying was the problem.
Well, we tried to have discovery conclude earlier, and the plaintiff kept insisting that there be further and further periods of time within which discovery could occur.
Why is there a need for discovery? I don't understand. Were you seeking discovery to prove that the plaintiff was a bad representative? Now, maybe he is because of the spoliation of evidence. But you don't need extensive discovery to say maybe this class should be certified, but not with this plaintiff.
We took our discovery, and it's of record in the summary judgment, and we believe it does show the unsuitability of the plaintiff for that.
In any event, our task at this stage is, I'm sorry if I've sent you down the wrong path, our task is not to assess blame, but to figure out the consequence. And one possible consequence is that because this case has not been certified as a class action, it should be returned to state court. There is, as I mentioned to Mr. Halicki, a conflict among the district courts. There appears to be no appellate authority on this question. It's a conflict among the district courts has been around since this act was passed about whether, if there's no class certified, it has to go back to state court. And neither side's brief pays any attention to that, although it's the opening jurisdictional question in this case. So what happens? Case is filed as a class, not certified as a class. It's decided as an individual action. What happens?
Your Honor, we believe it's appropriate and appropriately commonplace in the district courts of all the nation for class actions to be resolved as individual claims before a class is eventually certified.
Yes, if there's federal jurisdiction over the individual claim.
We would argue
there is no federal jurisdiction over Mr. Greenberger's individual claim. There's only federal jurisdiction over a claim involving more than 100 people and more than $5 million in stakes. And Mr. Greenberger's claim doesn't meet those requirements.
Well, there's jurisdiction at the moment that Mr. Greenberger's claim is in the federal court by virtue of being attached to that matter, Your Honor. And the question then is, at what time appropriately would the court not wish to have a judgment on the individual claim?
It's obvious that neither side has given this a moment's thought. We will give both of you 14 days to file supplemental briefs addressing the question whether the lack of a class certification means that there is no federal jurisdiction.
As to the remaining issues in the argument, we believe the court has very appropriately called attention to the holding in the Avery case that defeats the claim which Mr. Greenberger is attempting to advance in this matter. In particular, the Avery court held that the determination of the pre-loss condition of the subclass members' vehicles would require the individual examination of vehicles. And clearly that is equally so with Mr. Greenberger's vehicle. His vehicle cannot be examined, and there is a very significant and well-reasoned line of cases out of the various courts of appeal indicating that where the car is unavailable, whether it is an issue of blame or not of blame, it is simply not fair or correct under the law of spoliation to permit the matter to proceed forward. That was true in particular in the Troll versus Volkswagen case out of the First Circuit, the Bass case out of the Eighth Circuit, and is also true in Allstate versus Sunbeam. And so where vehicles or the subject matter of a lawsuit have been destroyed or given away, and in some of those cases there was blame on the part of the supposed spoliator, in at least one of the cases the Court of Appeals said that was not relevant and not significant. In all those cases, the party was then not permitted to put on any evidence of the physical condition of the spoliated, destroyed, or absent object. Here, of course, that's the 1994 Acura, and because that is not present, there cannot be a prove-up of this claim. And for that reason, it's particularly appropriate to affirm the grant of summary judgment rather than to have the case go forward and send it back for any purpose of further litigation.
I'm not sure it makes any difference. Were there any photographs taken of the vehicle?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There's the estimate. in the first place. And while we're talking about estimates, counsel made reference to the Lakeside estimate, which is, of course, the December 2002 estimate. But Mr. Greenberger did not argue in resisting the summary judgment, which is upon review before Your Honors today. Mr. Greenberger did not argue the Lakeside estimate as particular evidence. Instead, at pages 11 and 12 of his brief, which was the section devoted to that particular issue, he argued entirely the supposed expert report of Mr. Klein. And so, really, the issue of the Lakeside estimate is really not one framed for the district court and one upon which reversal should not be founded, were this court inclined to look at the Lakeside estimate. But turning to the Klein report, again, Mr. Klein never saw the car, and Avery says he must. And an expert who never saw the car is in a particularly poor position. As we've seen in the jurisprudence of this court, the 1992 Cladoris case, they argue in their brief that we had somehow waived the argument that Mr. Klein's report did not comport with the requirement that it be helpful under Rule 702. And, of course, we argued both below and in this court the Zenith decision authored by Chief Judge Easterbrook. And in the Zenith decision, of course, the court was applying Daubert.
What difference does it make who was the author of an opinion?
None, I suppose, Your Honor.
Why do you bring it up?
It just came to mind.
Common arguments just don't have any purchase.
The Zenith case is a good case, and in the Zenith case, this court was applying the Daubert and Kumho Tire decisions as well as the Joyner decision and appropriately determined that an expert who was merely arguing the say-so of his over a subject matter, in that case, matters relating to radio stations in Puerto Rico, was not, even if he was the world's greatest expert in the technical subject matter, was not empowered in that matter to opine in a way that was an analytic technique of helpfulness. He wasn't using an analytic technique that other experts in his field might have used, and for that reason, the court affirmed the judgment that rested upon the exclusion of his testimony. And so it should be here with Mr. Klein, who, even if he were a tremendous expert in automotive repair, which we believe his report does not prove up, Mr. Klein, nonetheless, not only didn't examine the car, but is not using anything that resembles a particularly helpful scientific methodology. There's no scientific methodology called inferential examination of a car through estimate. And so Mr. Klein is not using a paradigm or an analytic method, to borrow from the Zenith holding, which is of any particular help to anyone. And for that reason, Mr. Klein is no basis to deny the summary judgment. Turning to the fraud claim, that is the common law fraud claim, is even more clear than the contract claim. As to the common law fraud claim, the court did not err in granting summary judgment. They have absolutely no evidence of reliance in any particular statement. As the court's questions a few minutes ago elucidated, they did not cite any particular affirmative statement. The false statement that they assert is allegedly the false promise, which is the promise in the contract to repair the car. It is the self-same promise, and that cannot support an independent claim under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. And more importantly, as to the common law fraud claim, there is literally no mention of the word reliance in their response to GEICO's summary judgment motion below. We fulfilled our burden under Celotex. We rolled the rock up the hill and said, we have made a proper showing that there is no evidence of reliance in this record. And having done that, they rested on the allegations of their pleadings, as Rule 56 expressly prohibits, and said, no, you don't understand. Paragraph 62 and 3 of our complaint, please. And, of course, under both the face of the rule and Celotex, you cannot do that. And lacking any discussion of reliance, the court's determination of summary judgment was manifestly proper. Turning then to the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act claim, which the parties spend a considerable amount of time discussing, they concede that the appropriate standard of review for the review of the denial of leave to add the third amended complaint is abuse of discretion and not de novo review. The third amended complaint is the place where they press this false promise claim, which they had not pressed for 2 years in the matter and which would have significantly altered the premises of the matter. However, they merely regurgitated the same pleading points of the first amended complaint and the second amended complaint, and so it was dismissed again. The district court had this right. The district court was trying to determine how appropriately to treat their sort of tautological claim of false promise. It's kind of an Iqbal Twombly thing. They just say, oh, it's a false promise. It just is. And we really don't know why it's a false promise. But at the end of the day, Avery says that you cannot have a breach of contract claim founded on merely the self-same claim of false promise, and they say, well, it's a scheme, and they argue that it is a scheme. But there's a line of cases in the Northern District of Illinois and on into the state courts of appeal, which indicates that where basically any antecedent conduct, here, for example, an omission to say before the policy, hey, I'm going to lie to you in that policy, it's really just a very thin bootstrap, which amounts to the exact same argument. It amounts to the very prohibited thing in Avery, which is twinning your contract claim as an ICFA claim, even if the alleged omission to state occurs immediately in time before the entry into the contract. They try to save this by saying, well, consumer protection concerns are implicated, citing the Demetrio case, and I guess it would be an unfortunate case under ICFA if it had nothing to do with consumers. However, the Demetrio case does not stand for such a general proposition, nor could such a general assertion redeem a claim of this type. In the Demetrio case, the particular discussion was that unfairness can give rise to a claim under the ICFA. And there are three different factors the Court of Appeals, the Illinois Court of Appeals, explained that could bear on that: public policy, oppression, and substantial injury. And the court in that case found that there was truly oppressive conduct, where General Motors Automotive Corporation had repossessed a vehicle wrongfully while it had a contract extension, letting the gentleman in the case redeem his late payments for only $2,200. They not only repossessed it while that agreement was still alive, but then said you can't have your car back unless you pay the entire owed balance of $39,000. That really has nothing to do with and is not remotely parallel to the facts of this case, which again are a simple breach which plaintiff is attempting improperly under the law to twin into a claim under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. And so it is that Demetrio also does not redeem their claim. Turning back then to the subject matters relating to the car, since we have a little bit of time on that, we also see that the district court appropriate
legal obligation to use all of your time.
Your Honor, we just have a couple more things to say, and we'll be happy to recess then, Your Honor. Thank you. The cooperation clause in the case was breached by Mr. Greenberger, and the district court very appropriately pointed that out in hearing his motion for reconsideration below. Mr. Greenberger thwarted the ability of GEICO to elect whether to pay for the loss or, instead of paying for his loss, to cause the car to be repaired. If Mr. Greenberger had come forward with his Lakeside estimate in December of 2002 and said, aha, I believe I have a claim for loss. There is a different amount of money here. I would like that different amount of money. GEICO could have sent that car over to the automobile repair shop that it told him about in July in the deposition attached to summary judgment, and he could have had the car fixed, and we could have avoided this entire litigation, which is preferable. That goes to the appraisal clause issue that Your Honor asked about a few minutes ago. In fact, GEICO litigated a summary judgment argument about that appraisal issue below and had summary judgment denied. GEICO believes, although we did not take a cross appeal from that, that Mr. Greenberger's not availing himself of the appraisal process is hand in glove with his thwarting of the opportunity to repair or to replace. This policy is laden with means to avoid litigation and to avoid unnecessary cost and expense to parties. And in this case, the plaintiff passed every single exit ramp without then diverting to one of these helpful mechanisms.
Did Mr. Klein ever see the automobile?
Mr. Klein has never seen the automobile, Your Honor. And he can never see the automobile. If, in fact, the suit had been filed back in 2002, we would have all had a fighting chance to go find the automobile. But it was filed in 2005, unfortunately, and the automobile was very long gone after donation in December 2002 when it left custody of Mr. Greenberger. So GEICO's choice to either pay for the loss or fix that Acura was thwarted by his action. The court appropriately determined that that was a breach of the cooperation clause, a breach of our opportunity to elect among either payment or repair. And by doing that, that breach of contract is independently a defense to the breach. Additionally, there's literally no record evidence that the $3,784.69, the $495 Your Honor referred to earlier, if you will, there's no record evidence that that dollar amount was inadequate to pay this claim. Mr. Greenberger's deposed. He never says that he knows. The lakeside estimate is not of evidence in this record. And Mr. Klein doesn't offer a dollar opinion. His opinion is directed toward particular repairs in the estimate. But as Your Honor pointed out earlier, the contract is not a covenant for particular repairs, referring here back to the Levy case that reminded counsel of that. Instead, it is a covenant to repair the car. And Mr. Greenberger said in his deposition he didn't take it in because that would have been a hassle at page 50 of his deposition. But that's the covenant. It's not a covenant for Mr. Klein's particular repair analysis. And so there's literally no evidence here that the proffer of cash wasn't enough to pay for the car. And for that reason, Mr. Greenberger's claim is likewise infirm. For all these reasons, we believe the court should affirm. And thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. Anything further, Mr. Halecki?
Yes, Your Honor. Very briefly, the Daubert issue was waived. They didn't raise it until the motion to reconsider. And yes, Your Honor, photos of the vehicle were taken, and they are available. Other than that, we rest on our submissions for the remainder of the issues. Thank you very much.
All right. And the court gives counsel for both sides 14 days to file supplemental memoranda concerning the effect on federal jurisdiction of the district court's failure to certify a class action. Now, this case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of Casanova against American Airlines.